The plot thickens now. We get closer and closer to home. We're in this 62nd chapter. Of course, Moroni is very, very glad and relieved to receive Pahoran's letter, see? And he, I wonder if he felt cheap or something when he found out he'd been completely wrong after all this shouting and raging and ranting against Pahoran. His heart was filled with exceeding joy to find out that he wasn't a traitor as he thought he had been. He really jumped the gun that time, but at the same time, he mourned exceedingly. Moroni is something of a manic depressive, isn't he? He's an overachiever. He's a genius, a military genius, and he only lives a very short life. He just wears himself out, I think. He's that sort of person. You get these beautiful character delineations in the Book of Mormon. So we learn that things are often wrong with the world, but be careful how we place the blame. We don't want to do things like that. After all, who raised Noriega to power? That's a question. Well, and here's the sacral state, who had rebelled against their country and also their God. You can't rebel against the country in a sacral state. Remember, this is a religious state like Israel. You don't divide the state from the church. We don't do that here, as you know. Well, in Utah, it may be different. Moroni took a small number of men and gave... So the war isn't up yet, so they're going to have a mopping up operation. He takes a small number of men and gave Lehi and Tiamam command over the army. He says, I'm leaving them in your trust. Now I'm going to go out and I'm joined Pahoran, and we'll clean up here. And he raises the standard of liberty, you see, in the fourth one. In whatsoever place he did enter. So this is traditional. The standard attracts people. It's very interesting. It's the standard. Notice it says, and it came to pass, thousands did flock unto his standard. The Egyptians used the same place, same word for standard that they used for rallying place, a great ceremonial center. The word is iat. And it's usually written just like this. This was, as we find in the old picture, it's a mound with stones around it, megalithic stones around. It's a sacred meeting place, the iat. And you could write it the same way this way. This is a standard, and you'd have the bird or one of the 42 emblems of the tribes there on the standard. But the standard brings you to the meeting place, and it does here. The same thing in England. The king would raise his banner at Nottingham, and all the people would have to come. Well, of course, we find out in the sagas and so forth, when you receive the heror, the war arrow of the king, you must come to his presence within 3 days or be banished for 3 years from the kingdom. You must come. See, this is a universal rule in the ancient world. Well, so thousands flock to his standard. They're still observing these things. These things are remarkable uniformity, don't they? And we'll find right down to our own times they do. And they gave a force which was stronger even than the force of Pacus. He combined his force of Pahoran. Now, Pacus is a very interesting name. Of course, perfectly good Egyptian means he who is praised, he who is blessed, to be blessed. Pacus is to be blessed. Pacus is a person, any person who's praised, addressed, blessed, or favored of God. So, a good Egyptian name there, Pacus. And they became stronger than the men of Pacus. The same word in Muhammad. Muhammad means the same thing. Muhammadah means upon who is blessed or who is praised. It means the same thing as Pacus. And so they went to the land of Zarahemla against the cities. You remember, and met the men of Pacus. And behold, Pacus was slain, and the men were also taken prisoner. And Pahoran was restored to the judgment seat, and everything is as it was before. Is that it? Everything as it was before. What verse is that? Oh, yes, that's a very interesting poem. I must find that and read it to you someday. It's very good. And also the king men were put in their place, and whoever wouldn't take up arms in defense of the city but would fight against it, notice, were still resorting to arms, but would fight against, not because of their political views they were put to death, but they were still resorting to arms here, but would fight against it and were put to death. And speedy execution, and Pahoran, having restored peace to the land of Zarahemla, very severe nevertheless, but he is now free to join an army of 6,000 men and go out and send aid to Helaman. It's interesting, the average army throughout ancient times, the Middle Ages, for expeditions and so forth, is between 4,000 and 8,000 men. Same thing. You notice in the next verse, another army of 6,000 men. That's the standard. Well, the division, 101st Division, only had 7,000 men in it. The average division has 27,000, but of course everyone has just 7,000. They have to cover the same front as the full division. 6,000 men with sufficient quantity of food be sent to the armies of Lehi and Tiancum. So they're being supported everywhere. This is, I say, almost call it mopping up operations. And Moroni and Pahoran took their march with a large body of men toward the land of Nephi. Remember, Nephi was the one he wanted to take, in which he was so disappointed. That was, if they could he was going to roll up all the cities, roll up the whole front, you know, and begin to get Nephi. Nephi was their strong point. And Amorim ran over it, wiped it out, and all the other cities along with it. So they have to get back Nephi now. As they were marching, this is rather typical, they ran into somebody, a large body of Lamanites, and they slew many of them, and they had a fight and took provisions of war, but the rest of them gave in willingly. Notice the war is over. Everybody is fed up with it here. They caused them to enter a covenant that they would no more take up their weapons of war against the Nephites, and then they trusted them. And when they entered into the covenant, they sent them to dwell with the people of Ammon, the peaceful people, which pleased them very much. See, they're fed up with it. They don't want any more of this. As we see in the 27th verse, he says here, many of the Lamanites that were prisoners were desirous to join the people of Ammon to become a free people. That's the idea of being free, you see. You're not free if you're in arms all the time. And Ammon, and they were in number about 4,000 who had not been slain. Well, this is a nice touch. No hard feelings here. We'll just let you go over and join the people. You can see the tension is off now. Nobody's out for blood or anything like that if you want to go into. And this happened too. Remember a very interesting instance down in southern Germany when we were moving down there just toward Berchtesgaden, where we got 101st delivered Berchtesgaden, delivered, you might say. Before we got there, there was busy traffic at a road, everything jammed up, tanks in this direction, everything all tangled up, and out directing the traffic was an American captain and a German major working together in perfect harmony, you see. They were from opposite sides, made no difference, the traffic had to be moved, and so they moved it. But there was a jam factory a few miles, a place called Vegel, where we were hiding out in the basement of a grain elevator, and near there was a jam factory, and our boys would get jam on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and the Germans would get jam on Mondays and Wednesdays. We agreed on that. This is the sort of thing, you know. There was no hard feelings there at all. What did we have against them, after all? It was the Battle of the Chieftains. We'll get to that presently. And so Nephi, the one to tell Nephi, that was the big thing, near the city of Nephi. And of course the Lamanites didn't come out against. This is the last time they pull a trick. So Moroni went forth in the darkness of night and came upon the top of the wall to spy it out. And there was a way to get, they put grappling irons over the wall and they got into the wall. And he caused his men to march forth and come upon the top of the wall and let themselves down in that part of the city. The west part, there's always an unguarded spot. No matter how well you think you have a place defended, there's always a weakest spot. There's a weakest spot in everybody's armor. There's a weakest spot in any defense you want, you see. There's a fatal spot. It never fails. You can count on that. This is what happens here. There's a spot that isn't watched. You just try to tie up humans. That's the game of chess is about, you see. But I've guarded everything. Everything's taken care of. He can't touch me, and suddenly he's got your king. It's like that. And I was reading in what's the name, Arthur Clarke. He wrote that, remember the man who was the first man to find radar, the principle of radar in World War II. If you had a million computers, and every computer made a million moves a second, how long would it take to play all possible games of checkers on a checkerboard? You have a million computers, each making a million moves a second. How many years would it, how many minutes would it take to play all possible games of checkers? Just checkers, not chess, not three-dimensional chess, anything like that. It would take 300 billion years to play all the games. Just, if you made a million times a million moves every second, it would take you 300 billion years. And it can be worked out very simply. It's factorial. You can just work it out and you'll see it comes out at that with your 32 pieces and their possible permutations and so forth. I think I got the figures right. Anyway, it's very high. Take lots and lots of time. Since the universe is only supposed to be about 10 or 15 billion years old, you see, 300 billion times a billion years is quite a while to go on with your chess game. It'd be getting boring by about that time, I think. Well, anyway, they found this on the west where the Lamanites hadn't camped. You can't be everywhere. And they let them down by means of their strong cords, and all within the walls of the city. And when the Lamanites woke, they found the Lamanites were inside the walls. They were only too happy to run away, to get out of the walls. They fled by the pass, and they found themselves surrounded, and they took a lot of prisoners of them. There's no great fighting here, and these are the ones that said, please let us go up and join the Ammonites, and we'll be only too happy to do so. Many of the Lamanites that were prisoners were desirous to join the people of Ammon and become a free people. So the climate had certainly changed, and the word had spread that Moroni allowed them a way out. And it was cheerfully granted to them according to their desires, 28th verse tells us here. Therefore, all the prisoners of Lamanites joined with the people of Ammon. Now, wasn't that nice? And these were the bad guys? And they began to labor exceedingly. They threw their hearts into it. This is the life. They appreciated what they were getting. This happens here. And tilling the ground, raising all manner of grain and flocks and herds, Nephites relieved of all the prisoners of war from the Lamanites. Now, this is exactly what runs through the whole history of the ancient world in any country. The same thing goes on entirely. I have some cases to mention here in a minute here, and you'll see this. And Moroni went forth from the Nephi to the land of Lehi. And when the Lamanites saw, again they became frightened. The tide had turned. The morale is shaken, you see. And Moroni and his army pursued them from city to city. See, it's a rout now. Until they were met by Lehi and Teancum, those two terrible commanders. And then they gave up. They'd had enough of it. To the land of Moroni, and all in one body. This is what they do, the redoubt. You notice you always fall back on the redoubt. And this would hit, that's why you said Berchtesgaden. All the plans for the last few months of the war were to fall back on one great redoubt, on one great center, and make that their standing point. They'd stand out and make that irresistible, and that was to be in the Austrian Alps at Berchtesgaden. And they pursued them from city to city, were met by Lehi and Teancum, and they went to the land of Moroni, and the people gathering together all in one body. It's the worst thing you can do, of course, is all you can do. See, it's psychological, get together for support, help, and so forth. So they were gathering, but you could see for months before, the German arms were all falling back to this one point, a redoubt, build a big redoubt in the Austrian Alps. It didn't work. Now, Amoron the king with the Lamanites was also with them, the king in the center and so forth. It's like the Battle of Flodden Field, where the Scots all gather closer and closer and closer around the king, and so finally they die out, as Walter Scott says, a fierce but fading fire. That's called the shield wall. Of course, that goes back to the Old Norse practice. It's regular in every battle. Because the king, see, it's the same as the Asiatic principle, he must form a shield wall around the king. He must be the last to go, so they'd form the shield wall. And the king would, and so you had many a battle ending with a fierce combat around the shield wall, which they usually broke through and so forth. As I say, in the Battle of Flodden Field in 1525-51. So the Lamanites were encircled. It was checkmate, see, the king was checked. He can't be killed, he has to be checked. And so Teancum was very, but they noticed back to the personal element. There wouldn't have been any of this if it hadn't been for men like Amoron. And Teancum was a hothead, and he was exceedingly angry with Amoron, took it as a personal grudge, because he considered that Amoron and his brother Amalickiah had been the cause of the whole thing, and really were, actually, if they hadn't been there to get things organized. You find that so. Remember, as Liddell Hart tells us, it comes back to individuals after all. It was came back to Hitler, after all. The bunker, that ended the war. But until Hitler was eliminated in the Berlin bunker, the war would go on. Teancum, in his anger, did go forth. And what he did, he went by night, he let himself down into the walls of the city, went forth with a cord from place to place, Ariadne's cord, insomuch that he did find the king, and had cast a javelin at him, and did pierce him in his heart. But at the same time, it cost him his life, too. He awakened his servants, and they pursued Teancum and slew him. So now we've got checkmate. The war is pretty well over by now, but you have to get to the heart of the nest. Well, it's like the ants. There's some sociologists have written like that. The human is like ants. As long as the queen is there, as long as the queen is defended at the center, the queen is the brain, the queen is the heart. As long as the queen is there, you have the swarm. But the hill, the ant hill, or what you call it. And so that's what you have. But as soon as she is eliminated, then they become completely disoriented. All the ants become completely disoriented and go and join the next queen they can find. And this is, are we built like that? Apparently we are. The ant heap. And so he got slain. Now Moroni marched and did drive them out of the land, and they did flee, and they did not return again that time against the Nephites. So they're out now. They fled, and so Moroni has won. And look at what's been going on at home. Are these the good guys? 40th verse. There had been murders and contentions and dissensions and all manner of iniquity among the people of Nephi. Nevertheless, for the righteous sake, this is a basic principle of the Talmud, of course. The Lord saves the righteous, the wicked, and everybody else for the sake of the righteous. He lets the show go on because there might be some who might repent. Of course, the famous story we know in the Bible of Abraham pleading for Sodom and Gomorrah. Mr. Kaplan mentioned that yesterday. Abraham pleaded for Sodom and Gomorrah, the wicked cities. There might be, he says, is there 50 righteous people in? Will you spare them? Yes. 25? Yes. 10? Yes. For sparing the wicked city for the sake of the righteous people that are in them. He says that's the only reason he's holding back his hand today, because there are enough righteous people to justify it. It's a well-known principle. Because of the prayers of the righteous, they were spared, the others. And here is a very interesting psychological note. Who is to blame for our circumstances? You say, well, we use this for Vietnam a lot. He's wicked, he's hardened, and so forth. He's insane because of the war. But it works both ways, as it tells us here. And you can see this a good deal. Behold, because of the great length of the war, you can hold on for a lot, but it breaks you down, he says. Between the Nephites and the Lamanites, many had become hardened. But, notice, next sentence, because of the exceeding great length of the war, and many were softened because of their affliction, had the opposite effect on others. They became softened. So don't blame the circumstances, how you react, insomuch that they did humble themselves. Those are the two ways you can react. You can become hardened, or you can become softened. And Moroni, because, could you say they really won? They'd been beaten so many times, they had suffered so much. That's the trouble, of course. We've always come in at the end of world wars and only been in a short time and had great success and been able to call the shots and this sort of thing. And so it's had the other effect, more the hardening effect. He returned to the city of Zarahemla, and also Helaman returned, great homecoming, to the place of his inheritance. And there was once more peace established among the people of Nephi. They talk about victory celebrations before in the Book of Mormon. There's no victory celebration here mentioned, which is very interesting. Now here it tells us that Moroni yielded up the command of his armies into the hands of his son, named Moroniha, retired to his own house that he might spend the remainder of his days in peace. Now, he could have been dictator. He was the national hero, of course. He could have been king. They just had a king, remember. The king men had taken over the city and run things. People were used to the idea of a king. The judges hadn't been in forever. This is only 40 years of judges after 600, more than 600 years in the country. They've only had about 40 years of judges. So they were perfectly willing to accept a king, but this 39-year-old dictator here is not a dictator. Remember, he keeps saying, I seek not for power, but to fill it down. He's serious. I do not seek for power. Doesn't like that, and he doesn't like the setting bud. So this is truth and not rhetoric when he says it. He was a great man. This happens, of course. Nobody loved to retire and take off and put on his civilian more than George Washington did. He was what do we call it? He was through and through a civilian at any rate. So he yielded up at his command and retired. Now, notice this, and peace was established among the people of Nephi, but it's only going to last 7 years. Imagine that. It's going to be sad, and the whole thing's going to break out again on a different level. There's lots of crime mixed up with it then. So it reads like the end of a novel. It tells us what happens to the characters and how they ended up, and they lived happily ever after, and this is the last we see of these. After that 7-year gap, it's going to be a new crowd that emerge. Expedient that regulations should be made again in the church, because the church had been considerably shaken up at this time. What had been going on back there? Remember, the kingmen had been in control. Their crowd has been running everything. They had driven out the Horan. The chief judge had been driven out. They've usurped the throne. Everything had been shaken up, which of course would include the church. And the church had to be practically reorganized here from ground up. Helaman and his brothers went forth to declare the word of God, just like missionaries from the field to the field. And to the power of convincing many people of their wickedness. This is the point. You had to show them that they were wrong, what they've been doing here, which did cause them to repent of their sins and to be baptized. The people are being baptized and repented all over again, convinced of their sins. So notice it says in the 46th verse, he did establish again the church. He had to refound the church, practically from the ground up. So this is what happens after the big shakeup. And this happened in Europe, of course, where the church had been out of contact during the two world wars. In a very short time, under their various leaders, they got strange doctrines and strange practices and terrible fights over who was authority and things like that. You might expect that. So they had to straighten things up after the war that way. And the government's restored, too. They have to choose judges again, choose new judges to replace the old ones that had been put in by the kingmen, 47. And their judges and their chief judges were chosen. So there's some more of it. And the people of Nephi then began to prosper again, and there was a real post-war boom. They began to grow exceeding rich. Next, we come to one of the very favorite passages in the Book of Mormon. People like to show this, quote this a lot, to show that you can be rich without being oppressive or any of the things that rich people shouldn't do, you see, because they weren't spoiled by being rich. Notwithstanding their riches or their strength or their prosperity, they were not lifted up in the pride of their eyes, neither were they slow to remember the Lord their God, but did humble themselves exceedingly before him. Notice, they did humble them. The word humble means humilis, the word level with the earth. It means equal. They were level, they were equal. And that's why they were rich as a people, but it wasn't one above another. They were not divided into classes. This comes later, as we soon learn, but not now. Well, that's fine. We can begin to grow rich as a people. We should. Brigham Young said more than once, I could make this people the richest people on earth, and he could have. He was certainly our ablest economist, perhaps the best businessman in American history. The way he could manage things and the way he could build up a personal fortune like that, paid no attention to it. He says, I would not walk across the street to make a deal, a business deal with anyone. But he couldn't help it. He says, he couldn't help getting rich. It was true, too. Well, anyway, they weren't lifted up. You don't have to be selfish. They were rich because they were humble, but they were humble and they were equal. But they had to work at it, notice. And it's only going to last 4 years. This is the thing. And they did pray unto the Lord continually. You have to work at it, this sort of thing. So much the Lord did bless them according to his word, and they did wax strong and prosper in the war, in the land. So they had a post-war boom here, moving on. Now Shiblon took possession. Now, see, this is the new generation. It's no longer Helaman, it's Shiblon. Shiblon's a good Arabic name, means young lion. Popular name with Semitic peoples. Ari is a very popular name in Israel, as you know. Ari means a lion. And this Shiblon is an Arabic word for a young lion. And he took possession of the sacred things. And he was a just man. And then, you see, the old order changeth here. Moroni died at the age of 47, you see, just a few years after he retired. Thus ended the 36th year of the reign of the judges. Died of wounds, or maybe he pushed himself too much, I'm afraid. And so what's the thing to do next? Colonizing, expanding, business, explode. Now they have to increase. That's what they do now. They really expand. They're not going to stay just there and get rich and prosperous without spreading out in all directions, seeking new lands, investments, and so forth. And that's what they do. The 33rd reign of the year, the judges, there was a large company, 5,400 men, went out of the land of Jerusalem to the land northward. So they're selling new lands. Remember, our frontier has always been toward the west. Theirs was always toward the north and the east. That's the way you move up in there. But mostly pushing toward the north, always, because we know where they landed in the south, across the coast of Peru, and came north. They've been moving north all along. So here's a company, and they go as a company, you see. Individuals have been going out. They go as, remember, we read very often about groups that went out to explore, and some of them didn't come back, and they found strange things and so forth. They've been moving around. And 4,400 men. Oh, darn, did I leave that? Oh, I did. Well, it's all right, I'll read it. I can remember it. The large company men, 5,000. And they went out of the land of Zarahem, the land northward. And it came to pass that Hagoth, very interesting name, you see. He has a Mycenaean name. You'd expect that. They're mixed up with all. Remember, in Lehi's day, excuse me, Israel was full of Greeks. The Egyptians were in occupation. And Egyptian weights and measures, the Egyptian count, everything was used. And the Egyptians, the whole 26th dynasty, they were supported by Greek mercenaries, the same thing. And they occupied all the coast towns of Palestine and so forth in the time of Lehi. And he was used to them. So you're going to get occasional Greek names in the Book of Mormon, you do. And he was an adventurous man, a curious man. And he built him an exceedingly large ship. He went up to the borders of the land bountiful. We're always told that's the far north on the seashore. By the land desolation. Notice bountiful and desolation are together. There's your coincidentia positorum. Remember before the war, the priest would stand out before the army in the battle scroll, point to the enemy's land and curse it as desolation, as Horma or Horeb, or Horeb, Horma desolation. Then bless the land of Israel as the land of plenty and the blessed land, and the land bountiful. So you have bountiful and desolation right together here, but it was a desolate land, to be sure of that. And they launched it into the West Sea, so they're on the Pacific coast here. And by the sea, the West Sea, by the Narrow Neck, well, that's misleading, because by the Narrow Neck, as you know, at Panama, the Panama Canal runs into the Atlantic on the west side and the Pacific on the east side. Remember, there's that bend in the peninsula and the canal. You enter the canal on the west side and you enter out on the east side in the Pacific because it's turned around. People don't realize that. So it happens to be by the narrow neck, so we can't say definitely this was the Pacific or this was the Atlantic, because it twists, it does a double turn. It goes right back on its, turns back on itself for a short space, right at the narrowest place. And so what's going on? But he was a real entrepreneur, you can see that. And especially when we get to the youngest son, Coriantumr, of Alma. Remember, Alma blesses his three sons, Coriantumr and first young Helaman, and Cybele and Coriantumr. And Coriantumr, he rebukes him. Coriantumr's a wild kid. He's done some things. Remember, he went over to the harlot in the land of Sharon. And he played around, and he was a wild. And Alma had a secret liking for him because he'd been the same way himself. And here's Coriantumr again. He's living up to character. He is a big-time entrepreneur. He, when they settle these places up north, he decides to supply them in the manner that Sam Brown and our brother Hammond supplied the people during the gold rush and got rich at that. Not on the gold, but on supplying the fools that were hunting for it. And so, 38th year, this man built other ships, and the first ship came back, reports, many more people in. There's great times up there. They got more people to go with them. They send out the land northward. So this boom's going on. Things are opening up in the far north. And they went there, and they never heard of them anymore. See, this is this idea of race scattered everywhere. Don't be too simple. They're going to mingle with all sorts of people. And we suppose they were drowned in the depths of the sea. Well, they could have reached the islands, of course, very well. That's what Heyerdahl showed. He went from the west coast. He went from Peru, remember, and went over the Kon-Tiki and showed that you could cross there and could be done in those days. And, of course, we know now from the legends of the people of the islands, the Samoans and so forth, they were capable of making these amazingly long sea voyages with hitting the spot, navigating with almost perfect accuracy by the stars and the winds and the currents. They knew things like that. So they could get along. And these people disappeared. We didn't know where they went, he said. And it came to pass that in this year, many people went forward under the land. They went by land. This is a frontier to the land northward. Thus ended the 38th year. And in the next year, Cybelen died also. And then Coriantum, who had been the next son, but he doesn't become judge because he's gone away, you see. He's in business. He's gone forth to the land northward in a ship to carry forth provisions to the people who had gone forth to the land. He's going to sell provisions. The story of Brother Hammond, remember, he joined the church in Hawaii, and then he came to San Francisco, was one of the first people to settle there. When the gold rush came, he soon discovered that he could make far more money by selling supplies in the gold fields than in Sacramento than he could seeking gold himself. And Sam Brannan came, and Sam Brannan made him his, and he and Sam Brannan entered into partnership, and soon they were the richest men in California, and Sam Brannan was the richest man in California. But the Lord told him to go west and join the saints in the valley. He had this, Brigham wrote him and so forth. So he went to Mormon Island and set up and started to sell stuff there. He had a huge covered wagon which he loaded with all sorts of goods, and it just sold like that because you couldn't get eggs, couldn't get anything there. And he'd make $1,000 a day, and this was really something. And the gold was very rich too at Mormon Island in the Sacramento River there. And he says he had a dream one night, and the dream told him to get going and join with the saints. And he said, no, I can stay here and then make a lot of money, and then think of all the good I can do for the church. I'll use it to bring the saints here. The next night he had the same dream. The dream was that a great flood of lava, of hot lava, filthy water, came rushing down the river, and the people went on panning gold and paid no attention to it, and it swallowed them up. And he barely escaped, and people were scrambling to escape. So, well, the third night, that was too much. So he sold out, and he came out. He came to Utah then, but his morals was, he used to say, don't ever get the idea that your duty is to get rich to help the Lord. The Lord has all the money he needs. He will take care of that. You don't worry about that. You do what he tells you to do. Of course, if he tells you to get rich, that's a different thing. But we use that, of course, as one of the articles of faith here, which it isn't. But the same thing happened, and I say Sam Brannon, you see Sam Brannon, the richest man in California, and he died a broken man. You know, I think they just made a film about that, yeah. Well, therefore, it became expedient for Shiblin to convert the sacred things. They couldn't go down to his brother Corian, who had gone forth selling all these goods, and upon his son Helaman. He was called Helaman, of course, being called after the name of his father, Helaman Jr. And he gives them the records. Now, all those engravings which were in possession of Helaman were written and set forth among the children of men throughout all the land. There were two National Geographics I should have brought along. One was the current, was current yesterday. It's the October for this year, the October Geographic. For the first time, it appears very clear that these are Mayan records, that the Mayans did keep extensive long written records. They didn't think so before. They think these were just the years of kings, and they were just the symbols of kings and so forth. It seems they had written records and the like. Of course, there's not many books that survived or anything like that. But he gave them the other things, the sacred things. This is very interesting, the Tiponi. They're mentioned later. We'll talk about them later. Nevertheless, these things were to be kept sacred and handed down from generation to generation. This is another type. You see, you have the national treasures all the time. The Hopis, wherever they travel, have the Tiponi. It's a big box with the sacred objects in it, certain corn things and certain vessels. And the Hebrews traveled with the Ark of the Covenant, which had the sacred things in it. It had the scroll of the law. It had the lulav. It had various other sacred objects. In it, the pomegranates and things. What do they have in that? In the Ark of the Covenant. And they had, Japanese, of course, have the sacred objects they handed out from the emperor to his son. They include a sword and a mirror. And these are the sacred objects that are handed down, that come down from early times. All people have them. Not all people, but they're usual to have them. The Tiponi, they call it. Tiponi, I remember what they are. They have certain kachinas and certain corn emblems. Well, very much like what the Hebrews had was something like a sheaf of corn bent over and tied. Very simple, very primitive sort of things in there that have been kept down from the earliest times. So these people had the sacred things too. And when we got them later, when Mormon hands them over, when Mormon's father hands them over to him. Nevertheless, these things really kept sacred. And there were some dissenters who had gone forth to the Lamanites. Notice, here we get this racial complication again. Lots of people had gone over to the Lamanites, and they did a silly thing. They stirred them up to anger against the Nephites. There were these hotheads still going. People resented it, those types. And it came to that, they were able to raise a numerous army against the people of Moroni, but it didn't work. They were driven back. So now we come to the book of Helaman, where really serious developments take place. After just 7 years, there came to be a serious difficulty among the people. We begin that way with a serious difficulty. You know, this history is never very happy, is it? Why does it have to? No wonder people don't like reading the Book of Mormon. It's not much happy talk. Long wars ruin everything. The people are fed up with war, so now they take to organized crime instead. I suppose that explains it. The question is, who should have the judgment seat? See, Pahoran had died. Now, who would have the judgment seat? Well, there were three sons of Pahoran, known by the name Pahoran, Pa'anki, and Pakumen. Pa'anki is the one indisputable Egyptian name in the Book of Mormon. Nobody can ever dispute that. Either that Joseph Smith could have invented it, or that it could not be pure 100% Egyptian, because Pa'anki is a very important person in Egyptian history. Just before Lehi today. Of course, it means Ammon is my life. And Pachumeni and Pahoran means the person of Syria, means the Syrian. That's when an Egyptian would call a person from Palestine or northern Palestine the Syrian. Pahoran means the Syrian. And so these are familiar Egyptian names. Now, these are not all the sons. He had a son, but they did form three divisions among the people, so they had an election. Pahoran was appointed, he was the oldest, by the voice of the people. They went for him, and his brother gave in, Pakumen. He said he conceded the election, but Pa'anki would not concede the election. There's quite a story about Pa'anki and Korihor. His son was Herihor. His father was Korihor, you see. There's a good book, another Book of Mormon name, the Egyptian Pa'anki, the founding of the dynasty there, Pa'anki and Korihor. His father was a high priest. He wasn't brave enough to take the Pharaoh's title to himself, but he gave the Pharaoh's title to his son, Pa'anki. He became the first Pharaoh of that dynasty. But this Pa'anki doesn't concede. He's exceedingly wroth, going to use the old flattery again to get the people to rise up in rebellion against their brethren. So more civil war after only 7 years. But he was condemned to death for that. People didn't want any of that. This was rebellion. But the people were angry. They backed him up, and so they hired a professional hitman to get rid of Pahoran. That's what they did. They were angry. Behold, they sent forth one Cush-Keman, even to the judgment seat, who murdered Pahoran as he sat on the judgment seat. And we're told that he was very expert in this sort of thing. And then, having done this murder, they all entered into a covenant. Notice here's another brotherhood, one of those negative brotherhoods here. Entered into a covenant, swearing by their everlasting maker, their religious brotherhood. And to tell no man, see, they have their oaths of secrecy, that Kish-Kumen had murdered Pahoran. Therefore, Kish-Kumen was in disguise at the time he murdered Pahoran. This kind of brotherhood. And Kish-Kumen and his band covenanted with him. See, they make covenants, and they covenant and swear by their maker, their everlasting maker. It's a solemn bond among themselves, and they're all crooks. And then they mingle themselves very respectably among the people. You don't know, this is the way to get away with it. The great criminals enterprise are highly respected sometimes. Some are at various levels. You don't know, mingling in the streets, or members in England or anywhere, or members of the IRA, or member of the Hezbollah, or members now in Greek, they're very eminent grave-robbing families. Everybody knows they're grave-robbing families. They've agreed they never tell their secrets or anything, their names, but everybody knows who they are. When this colonel I was talking about, he was in charge. They were going to open a new aerospace center in east of Athens at Tanagra. And when they started digging, they discovered a Tanagra grave with Tanagra figurines, which were extremely valuable. So immediately they stopped the whole operation. There was this huge Tanagra cemetery, very valuable. But that had been worked for generations by certain families, certain very dignified families. And they invited us to dinner and so forth and discussed their enterprises, their professional grave robbers. And in Egypt, the same way, some eminent families, professional grave robbers for generations. It's handed down from fathers to son, and dignified. They showed them the very easy way of finding where the people were buried. They couldn't figure out, where were these graves? Why did we miss them? It's the easiest thing in the world. Just prod the ground with the rod, and where it goes down in soft ground, there's a grave. And so they're finding graves all over the place. But the fact is that we have all sorts of people walking around amongst us now, don't we? Well, now who knows, things like, well, they make themselves show like skinheads and things like that. But Pakameni was appointed chief governor and so forth, and over the reign of the people. And 8 years later, this is what happens. After the last war, the Lamanites take advantage of this disruption. They take advantage of that, and so there's another war again on their hands now. But these secret societies, now that's the thing that becomes very important in the Book of Mormon here. I talked the last time about the great company. Well, this is how the time would organize. It was a great company, mostly English, but of others, the leaders were English. It operated in France because of the disagreements between the kings of France and England as to who could claim which territories. And the great company was organized to go and snatch everything they could, and the king would pay them off. There was the great company, but the great company was enlisted by Geoffrey de Guisland, the great hero, the great hero of the French, and he went to the aid of Henry the Bastard, who wanted to become a king of Spain instead of his brother, who was Pedro the Cruel, who was a notoriously cruel king. The other side was supported by John the Bad of Navarre, just the kind of people who have the king John the Bad, Pedro the Cruel, and so forth. Well, Pedro the Cruel was supported in his throne, though he was very unpopular, and his brother was very popular. He was supported on his throne by Edward the Black Prince, the son of Edward III, and the Black Prince was the one who loved no trail but a trail of blood. And he would hire himself out to anybody. And so he took an English company, the White Company, but he took his forces, and they had a terrific battle between Geoffrey de Guisland and the Black Prince, because at the age of 16, he had performed sensationally, Edward the Black Prince. He became the hero of Europe. Except on the other side, the question, the idea, who was to be the hero of Europe? Who was to be the idol? These two. It was purely between these two men, the companies. Well, what on earth would bring Edward down into Spain fighting for Pedro the Cruel? Money. He was offered 250,000 gold crowns if he'd do it. Not only that, but all the land and cities he could grab for himself on the side that didn't belong to the king. This was the kind of deal. Of course, Pedro didn't pay him a penny. He was a crook anyway. This is what went on, but he did it for money. And what was Guisland? He was just hiring himself out. He would have hired himself on the other side. There was the White Company on the other side, which was Some of you as kids may have read that. Conan Doyle's famous novel, The White Company, one of the best boys' books ever written. Quite a company that went down in Spain at that time. Well, these companies would hire themselves out, and they're all over the place. They're not only characteristic of that century, but every century you find them like that. Now, well, what happens when they go so far? I mean, they plunder and they clean up everything, and life becomes impossible for the poor peasants. They have to supply everything. They have no rights or anything like that. So they revolt, and right at this very time, just after this in the 70s, the 1370s, peasants started revolting under certain Jacques, became the Jacquerie, and it spread all over. And they started killing. They organized into bands, into roving bands. They were just dislanded peasants. They didn't have any lands, homes, or anything else. Everything had been burnt out. So they would organize themselves into desperate bands and go around plundering and rubbing whatever they could. The reply to that was, of course, the lords would join. Finally, the lords would join together. They were always fighting each other otherwise, and then wipe out the Jacquerie. That took a bit of doing, but then they'd start fighting among themselves again, and then another Jacquerie. Well, this is routine. This goes on. In the north, at the same time in the north, Stralsund was being besieged by Queen Margaret. Queen Margaret wanted to be queen of everything. She was queen of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden all at the same time. And in the 1370s was the siege of Stralsund, which was the most important German town belonging to the Hanse League. It was relieved during the siege by the Victual Brothers. They formed themselves into a solid brotherhood to deliver food to the town during the siege. So they called themselves the Vitalian Breeder. The Victual Brethren, Vitalian Breeder, and had Solomos and so on. Well, after the war was over, they were out of work. But they continued. They organized themselves now under the banner of Gottesfreunde aller Menschenfeinde, friends of God, but enemies to all man. And they raided everything on the sea. They just made the Baltic unsafe, except for there was one person that made it even more unsafe. If you talk about the 2,000 young boys, they're all in their teens. Well, there was one outfit at the mouth of the Vistula. There was a Vistula in the East Germany there. There was a huge castle right in the sand there. It stood on pylons, steel pylons, and it was stone pylons, and it was big, and it had a trapdoor underneath where you'd go in a boat and so forth. And it was run by Palnatoki, who was 12 years old. He was the terror of the Baltic. He would go down, he'd destroy anything. You know, and it was a sacred brother. They were the Jomsburg. They swore sacred vows. They were just like the Teutonic Knights on the shore, just opposite them and so forth. And everybody, these sacred bands going around to plunder everybody else under the name of holy deliverance, or out for themselves. The little old Palnatoki, only 12 years old, had everybody scared to death. And so it goes. And this sort of thing, well, why do they form sacred brotherhoods? Well, it's very obvious. They must, to keep from plundering each other. They have to trust each other. You have to trust somebody, see? If we form a brotherhood, the famous story, you remember what tale is it from Chaucer? The Squire's Tale? No, the partner's tale from Chaucer about the three crooks. Well, the point is they couldn't trust each other. They all kill each other. See, this is it. Each one, two of them gang together, and we'll put him out of the picture, and then we'll share it between ourselves, and then immediately, who's going to get it all? So you have to trust somebody if you're going to operate at all. So they would form these sacred oaths, and they would take these vows and so forth, and all this secret stuff, so that they could trust each other and wouldn't plunder each other. Well, now, this goes back much earlier, of course. The assassins, the old man of the mountain, the assassins, the terror in the time of the Crusade, in the 11th and 12th century, the old man of the mountain, the hashishim, our word assassin comes from that. Assassin is somebody who's hopped up on hashish, which is hemp, which is, which drug is hemp anyway? Well, anyway, you get yourself hopped up and then you go out and commit these murders under the effect of drugs. They're all young kids he had, the old man of the mountain. And he terrorized all the Middle East and started terrifying Europe. He could get anything he wanted. Well, we're the Medellin today. This is the way we do things, you see. This happens, the assassins and the mafia, they're a brotherhood, you see. They're families, they're the capo. But way back in the early days, hope I didn't bring my Book of Mormon along, but something else along. I don't mean Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price. But that round thing, the hypocephalus, belongs to, as the name is on it, to Sheshonq. Now, the Sheshonq kids founded the 22nd dynasty, and that's not an Egyptian name. They were the Ma, the Meshwesh, they were the Ma, the great chiefs of the Ma. Everybody This depends, we can put it this way. But now, so we don't have to go into this all day, but it's lots of fun. Every great emperor and king is a descendant of a bandit. I don't know any exception. There may be, but I've never found any yet who isn't descended from a bandit who acts just this same way. And so the great Meshwesh, they came in, and this time you had Egypt was being invaded, and there were foreign dynasties by the Meshwesh and the Tehemu, the Tenu, and the Temehu, and the Nahasi, and the Libu, all these tribes from the west and from the south, and what they would do would invade the Nile Valley and demand tribute for their armies to go away. Well, this one was hired by a king, by a great chief, a great prince, in Hieronymus, whose grandfather had been one, after five generations. Well, this man, he was the son of Nimrod, and his name was Sheshonk. He made himself indispensable, but the agreement usually was with these, you defend the land and so forth, we'll give you lands. They were given lands and estates, you see, to keep, and they'd take to farming with their serfs, whom they'd captured in their various raids, and they became very prosperous farmers, with the understanding that they were to come to the great lord's aid in time of war, and that was it. Well, very soon they built up their own strength. They didn't have to come to anybody's aid, and so the fifth generation, the Meshwesh, the great man of Ma, as they called him, the great chief of Ma, was ruling in Hieronymus, and then his daughter marries the daughter of the high priest of Thebes, and before you know it, by the fifth generation, I say, the 22nd dynasty is founded by the Sheshonkids. The Sheshonk, then Osakan, and then Takalot. Very interesting, we have a name Tubalot here, right from that dynasty. And Takalot, his name was. And then there's another Osakan, another Takalot, another Sheshonk. There were five Sheshonks. Well, this was the way they did it, you see. The tribes would take over, and then they'd become... But the pharaohs before them had done that. There's not, out of the 30 dynasties in Egypt, not... Well, maybe one or two of them was native Egyptian, but I doubt it. They were all from Asiatics or from the West, and then came the people of the sea, relatives of us. They were speaking, the peoples of the sea came in 1200. There was the Sicels from Sicily, the Sedani from Sardinia, the Pelasti who settled down in Palestine. There was the Achaioi, the Achaeans, who were the Greek-speaking people of Homer. The Philistines spoke Greek too, a language very closely related to our own. So they said, but they were all raiding people. They came as raiders and they settled down if they could take what they could, and if they couldn't take it, if their forces were broken, they would settle, they would make a deal and be settled down and join the king's own army and add to it. See, it's your chess game and so forth. Well, this was in Egypt. In Asia, it was even more active that way. And so we have these people of the sea, and the orders go on, I say, to keep from plundering each other. They form their sacred brotherhoods, but then their whole business, you'll find nothing. That's all that's been going on in the world, is people have been plundering each other, selling down. Where's your civilization? The old kingdom of Egypt, the only case where we find what might be called a real civilization. The rest of them are just taking over. What is the going established? It's amazing here. We forget about the other brotherhoods. If it wasn't for inspiration, if it wasn't for intervention from on high, nothing would ever happen except this sort of thing. Oh, in fact, I cut this out of the paper this morning, give us an example of what's going on in the world now. Then he goes down the list of things here, the capacity for meanness. I ask if there's no one in Iran, Syria, Lebanon, whose hearts and minds does not lead them to say, an end to this holding of hostages, but I see that the West Bank and other outrages against the kin of the hostage takers deadens the hearts and minds on both sides, you see. And then he said, I thought of the searing violence that people resort to get out of greed. The assassins of the drug cartels in Colombia had just murdered two television journalists in Bogota, continuing their reign of terror against all who oppose the leaders of this multi-billion dollar drug trade. See, it's loot and it's rival and it's build up. It's legit. It will soon build up a legitimate government. They think they're legitimate. This is what's been happening all along. See. Over the past weekend, five more people were killed in the District of Columbia, a total of 369 homicides in the nation's beautiful capital, you see, where the homicides in England over a year will be something like 15 or around 100. What is it? But it's not 369 so far this year in one city, and that in the capital, where order, which should be the model of order and decorum and control and all this sort of thing goes on. So we still need the Book of Mormon, see? We still need this sloppy stuff. Then I thought of a state-imposed inhumanity, murder, hostages taking, as I watched 70,000 black South Africans rally around 77-year-old Wallace Sisulu and others who were held hostage by South African government for 26 years until they were freed last week. Nelson Mandela still and others. And he goes on, the Nazis massacred hundreds in Lidice, the whole city and so forth, 1942. Well, we think of the Holocaust, and we think of My Lai, and Jamestown, and the Philadelphia, Mississippi murders. And he goes on, Idi Amin in Uganda. Oh, we're doing the same sort of thing today, and it's not getting better, it's getting worse. So I'm afraid we need the Book of Mormon after all. But how are we going to take it to heart? And see, we got this far with these various things. But this is the process we're following here. Notice these people are quite mobile. They form themselves into governments. Religion is the one thing that holds them together. But it's very fragile, very brittle. It breaks apart. There's always trouble arising within the people themselves. So we have this Coriantor Leach trouble. I thought we'd get them out of war for good into good, wholesome, everyday crime, but we haven't done it yet, so we'll have to take up here the next time.